Continuing with Rage on page 105. I slipped off my shoes and waited for her. I don't know how long it was before she came. I didn't have any wristwatch and was too stoned to be able to judge in any case. And after a little while, unease began to creep in. Something about the shadow of trees on the wet, packed sand and the sound of the wind. Maybe the ocean itself, a big thing, a mean mother humper full of unseen life and all those little pricks of light. Maybe the cold feel of the sand under my bare feet. Maybe none of those things, maybe all of them and more. But by the time she put her hand on my shoulder, I had lost my erection. Wyatt Earp striding into the OK Corral with no six gun. She turned me around, stood on tiptoe, kissed me. I could feel the warmth of her thighs, but now it was nothing special to me. "I saw you looking at me," is what she said. "Are you nice? Can you be nice?" "I can try," I told her, feeling a little absurd. I touched her breasts, and she held me close. But my erection was still gone. "Don't tell Pete," she said, taking me by the hand. "He'd kill me. We've got a kind of a thing." She led me underneath the back steps, where the grass was cool and matted with aromatic pine needles. The shadows made cold Venetian blinds on her body as she slipped out of her dress. "This is so crazy," she said, and she sounded excited. Then we were rolling together, and my shirt was off. She was working at the snap on the front of my jeans, but my cock was still on coffee break. She touched me, sliding her hand inside my underpants, and the muscles down there jerked, not in pleasure or in revulsion, but in a kind of terror. Her hand felt like rubber, cold and impersonal and antiseptic. "Come on," she whispered. "Come on, come on, come on." I tried to think of something sexy, anything sexy. Looking up Darlene Andreessen's skirt in study hall and her knowing it and letting me. Maynard Quinn's pack of dirty French playing cards. I thought of Sandy Cross in sexy black underwear, and that started to move something around down there. And then, of all things, to come cruising out of my imagination, I saw my father with his hunting knife talking about the Cherokee nose job.
"The what?"
Corky Harold asked. I explained the Cherokee nose job. "Oh," Corky said. I went on. That did it. Everything collapsed into noodledom again. And after that, there was nothing. And nothing. And nothing. My jeans had joined my shirt. My underpants were somewhere down around my ankles. She was quivering underneath me. I could feel her like the plucked string of a musical instrument. I reached down and took hold of my penis and shook it as if to ask what was wrong with it. But Mr. Penis wasn't talking. I let my hand wander around to the warm junction of her thighs. I could feel her pubic hair. A little kinky, shockingly like my own. I slid an exploratory finger into her, thinking, this is the place. This is the place men like my father joke about on hunting trips and in barber shops. Men kill for this. Force it open, steal it, or bludgeon it. Take it, or leave it.
"Where is it?"
Dana whispered in a high, breathless voice.
"Where is it? Where?"
So I tried. But it was like that old joke about the guy that tried to jam a marshmallow into the piggy bank. Nothing. And all the time I could hear the soft sound of the ocean grounding on the beach, like the soundtrack of a sappy movie. Then I rolled off. "I'm sorry." My voice was shockingly loud, rasping. I could hear her sigh. It was a short sound, an irritated sound.
"All right," she said. "It happens."
"Not to me," I said, as if this was the first time in several thousand sexual encounters that my equipment had malfunctioned. Dimly I could hear Mick Jagger and the Stones shouting out, "Hot stuff," one of life's little ironies. I still felt wrecked, but it was a cold feeling, depthless. The cold certainty that I was queer crept over me like rising water. I had read someplace that you didn't have to have any overt homosexual experience to be queer. You could just be that way and never know it until the queen in your closet leaped out at you like Norman Bates' mom in Psycho, a grotesque mugger prancing and mincing in mommy's makeup and mommy's shoes. "It's just as well," she said. "Pete, look, I'm sorry." She smiled, but it looked manufactured. I've wondered since if it was or not. I'd like to believe it was a real smile.
"It's the dope.
I bet you're a hell of a lover when things are right." "Fuck," I said, and shivered at the dead sound in my own voice. "No," she sat up. "I'm going back in. Wait until I'm gone a while before you come up." I wanted to tell her to wait, to let me try it again, but I knew I couldn't, not if all the seas dried up and the moon turned to zinc oxide. She zipped into her dress and was gone, leaving me there under the steps. The moon watched me closely, perhaps to see if I might cry. I didn't. After a little while, I got my clothes straightened around and most of last fall's leaves brushed off me. Then I went back upstairs. Pete and Dana were gone. Joe was over in a corner making out with a really stunning girl who had her hands in his mop of blonde hair. I sat down and waited for the party to be over. Eventually it was. By the time the three of us got back to Bangor, Dawn had already pulled most of her tricks out of her bag, and a red edge of sun was peering down at us from beneath the smokestacks of beautiful downtown Brewer. None of us had much to say. I felt tired and grainy and not able to tell how much damage had been done to me. I had a leaden feeling that it was more than I really needed. We went upstairs, and I fell into the tiny day bed in the living room. The last thing I saw before I went to sleep was bars of sunlight falling through the Venetian blinds and onto the small throw rug by the radiator. I dreamed about the creaking thing. It was almost the same as when I was small. I in my bed, the moving shadows of the tree outside on the ceiling, the steady, sinister sound. Only this time, the sound kept getting closer and closer until the door of the bedroom burst open with an awful crack like the sound of doom. It was my father. My mother was in his arms. Her nose had been slit wide open, and blood streamed down her cheeks like war paint. "You want her?" he said. "Here, take her, you worthless good-for-nothing. Take her." He threw her on the bed beside me, and I saw that she was dead. And that's when I woke up screaming. With an erection. Chapter 27. Nobody had anything to say after that one. Not even Susan Brooks. I felt tired. There didn't seem to be a great deal left to say. Most of them were looking outside again, but there wasn't anything to see that hadn't been there an hour before. Actually less, because all of the pedestrians had been shooed away. I decided Sandra's sex story had been better. There had been an orgasm in hers. Ted Jones was staring at me with his usual burning intensity. I thought, however, that revulsion had given way entirely to hate, and that was mildly satisfying. Sandra Cross was off in her own world. Pat Fitzgerald was carefully folding a cheap piece of study hall math paper into an aerodynamically unsound aircraft. Suddenly, Irma Bates said defiantly, "I have to go to the bathroom." I sighed. It sounded a great deal like the way I remembered Dana Collette's sigh at Scudic Point. "Go, then." She looked at me unbelievingly. Ted blinked. Don Lordi snickered. "You'd shoot me." I looked at her. "Do you need to go to the crapper or not?" "I can hold it," she said sulkily. I blew out my cheeks the way my father does when he's put out. "Well, either go or stop wiggling around in your seat. We don't need a puddle underneath your desk." Corky went ha-ha at that. Sarah Pastor and looked shocked. As if to spite me, Irma got up and walked with flat-footed vigor toward the door. I had gained at least one point. Ted was staring at her instead of me. Once there, she paused uncertainly, hand over the knob. She looked like someone who has just gotten an electric shock while adjusting the TV rabbit ears and is wondering whether or not to try again. "You won't shoot me?" "Are you going to the bathroom or not?" I asked. I wasn't sure if I was going to shoot her. I was still disturbed by, jealous of, the fact that Sandra's story seemed to have so much more power than my own. In some undefined way, they had gained the upper hand. I had the crazy feeling that instead of my holding them, it was the other way around. Except for Ted, of course. We were all holding Ted. Maybe I was going to shoot her. I certainly didn't have anything to lose. Maybe it would even help. Maybe I could get rid of the crazy feeling that I had waked up in the middle of a new dream. She opened the door and went out. I never raised the gun off the blotter. The door closed. We could hear her feet moving off down the hall, not picking up tempo, not breaking into a run. They were all watching the door as if something completely unbelievable had poked its head through, winked, and then withdrawn. For myself, I had a strange feeling of relief, a feeling so tenuous that I could never explain it. The footfalls died out. Silence. I waited for someone else to ask to go to the bathroom. I waited to see Irma Bates dash crazily out of the front doors and right onto the front pages of 100 newspapers. It didn't happen. Pat Fitzgerald rattled the wings of his plane. It was a loud sound. "Throw that goddamn thing away," Billy Sawyer said irritably. "You can't make a paper plane out of study hall paper." Pat made no move to throw the goddamn thing away. Billy didn't say anything else. New footfalls coming toward us. I lifted up the pistol and pointed it toward the door. Ted was grinning at me, but I don't think he knew it. I looked at his face, at the flat, conventionally good-looking planes of his cheeks, at the forehead, barricading all those memories of summer country club days, dances, cars, Sandy's breasts, calmness, ideals of rightness. And suddenly I knew what the last order of business was. Perhaps it had been the only order of business all along. And more importantly, I knew that his eye was the eye of a hawk and his hand was stone. He could have been my own father, but that didn't matter. He and Ted were both remote and Olympian, gods. But my arms were too tired to pull down temples. I was never cut out to be Samson. His eyes were so clear and so straight, so frighteningly purposeful. They were politicians' eyes. 5 minutes before, the sound of the footfalls wouldn't have been bad, you see. 5 minutes before, I could have welcomed them, put the gun down on the desk blotter and gone to meet them, perhaps with a fearful backward glance at the people I was leaving behind me. But now it was the steps themselves that frightened me. I was afraid Philbrick had decided to take me up on my offer, that he had come to shut off the main line and leave our business unfinished. Ted Jones grinned hungrily. The rest of us waited, watching the door. Pat's fingers had frozen on his paper plane. Dick Keene's mouth hung open, and in that moment I could see, for the first time, the family resemblance between him and his brother Flapper, a borderline IQ case who had graduated after 6 long years in Placerville. Flapper was now doing postgraduate work at Thomaston State Prison, doing doctoral work in laundry maintenance and advanced spoon sharpening. An unformed shadow rose up on the glass, the way it does when the surface is pebbly and opaque. I lifted the pistol to high port and got ready. I could see the class out of the corner of my right eye, watching with absorbed fascination, the way you watch the last reel of a James Bond movie when the body count really soars. A clenched sound, sort of a whimper, came out of my throat. The door opened, and Irma Bates came back in. She looked around peevishly, not happy to find everyone staring at her. George Yannick began to giggle and said, "Guess who's coming to dinner?" It didn't make anyone else laugh. It was George's own private yuck. The rest of us just went on staring at Irma. "What are you looking at me for?" she asked crossly, holding the knob. "People do go to the bathroom, didn't you know that?" She shut the door, went to her seat, and sat down primly. It was almost noon. Chapter 28. Frank Philbrick was right on time. Chink, and he was on the horn. He didn't seem to be puffing and blowing as badly, though. Maybe he wanted to placate me. Or maybe he'd thought over my advice on his speaking voice and had decided to take it. Stranger things have happened, God knows. "Decker, I'm here. Listen, that stray shot that came through the window wasn't intentional. One of the men from Lewiston..." "Let's not even bother, Frank," I said. "You're embarrassing me and you're embarrassing these people down here who saw what happened. If you've got any integrity at all, and I'm sure you do, you're probably embarrassing yourself." Pause. Maybe he was collecting his temper. "Okay, what do you want?" "Not much. Everybody comes out at 1 o'clock this afternoon, in exactly," I checked the wall clock, 57 minutes by the clock down here. Without a scratch, I guarantee you." "Why not now?" I looked at them. The air felt heavy and nearly solemn, as if between us we had written a contract in someone's blood. I said carefully, "We have a final piece of business down here. We have to finish getting it on." "What is it?" "It doesn't concern you, but we all know what it is." There wasn't a pair of eyes that showed uncertainty. They knew all right, and that was good, because it would save time and effort. I felt very tired. "Now listen carefully, Philbrick, so we have no misunderstanding, while I describe the last act of this little comedy. In about 3 minutes, someone is going to pull down all the shades in here." "No way they are, Decker." He sounded very tough. I let the air whistle through my teeth. What an amazing man he was. No wonder he screwed up all his drive-safely spiels. "When are you going to get it through your head that I'm in charge?" I asked him. Someone is going to pull the shades, Philbrick, and it won't be me. So if you shoot someone, you can pin your badge to your ass and kiss them both goodbye. Nothing. Silence gives consent, I said, trying to sound merry. I didn't feel merry. I'm not going to be able to see what you're doing either, but don't get any clever ideas. If you do, some of these people are going to get hurt. If you sit until one, everything will be fine again, and you'll be the big, brave policeman everybody knows you are. Now, how about it? He paused for a long time. I'm damned if you sound crazy, he said finally. How about it? How do I know you're not going to change your mind, Decker? What if you want to try for 2 o'clock or 3? How about it? I asked inexorably. Another pause. All right, but if you hurt any of those kids, you'll take away my junior achiever card. I know. Go away, Frank. I could feel him wanting to say something warm, wonderful, and witty. Something that would summarize his position for the ages. Something like, fuck off, Decker, or cram it up your ass, Decker. But he didn't quite dare. There were, after all, young girls down here. 1 o'clock, he repeated. The intercom went dead. A moment later, he was walking across the grass. What nasty little masturbation fantasies have you got lined up now, Charlie? Ted asked, still grinning. Why don't you just cool it, Ted? Herman Jackson asked remotely. Who will volunteer to close the shades? I asked. Several hands went up. I pointed to Melvin Thomas and said, do it slowly, they're probably nervous. Melvin did it slowly. With the canvas shades pulled all the way down to the sills, the room took on a half-dreamlike drabness. Lackluster shadows clustered in the corners, like bats that hadn't been getting enough to eat. I didn't like it. The shadows made me feel very jumpy indeed. I pointed to Tanis Gannon, who sat in the row of seats closest to the door. Will you favor us with the lights? She smiled shyly, like a Deb, and went to the light switches. A moment later we had cold fluorescents, which were not much better than the shadows. I wished for the sun and the sight of blue sky, but said nothing. There was nothing to say. Tanis went back to her seat and smoothed her skirt carefully behind her thighs as she sat down. To use Ted's adequate phrase, I said, there is only one masturbation fantasy left before we get down to business, or two halves of one whole, if you want to look at it that way. That is the story of Mr. Carlson, our late teacher of chemistry and physics, the story that good old Tom Denver managed to keep out of the papers, but which, as the saying goes, remains in our hearts. And how my father and I got it on following my suspension. I looked at them, feeling a dull, horrid ache in the back of my skull. Somewhere it had all slipped out of my hands. I was reminded of Mickey Mouse as the Sorcerer's Apprentice in the old Disney cartoon Fantasia. I had brought all the brooms to life, but now where was the kindly old magician to say abracadabra backwards and make them go back to sleep? Stupid, stupid. Pictures whirled in front of my eyes, hundreds of them, fragments from dreams, fragments from reality. It was impossible to separate one from the other. Lunacy is when you can't see the seams where they stitched the world together anymore. I suppose there was still a chance that I might wake up in my bed, safe and still at least half sane, the black irrevocable step not taken, or at least not yet. With all the characters of this particular nightmare retreating back into their subconscious caves. But I wasn't banking on it. Pat Fitzgerald's brown hands worked on his paper plane like the sad, moving fingers of death itself. I said, Chapter 29. There was no one reason why I started carrying the pipe wrench to school. Now, even after all of this, I can't isolate the major cause. My stomach was hurting all the time, and I used to imagine people were trying to pick fights with me, even when they weren't. I was afraid I might collapse during physical education calisthenics and wake up to see everybody around me in a ring laughing and pointing, or maybe having a circle jerk. I wasn't sleeping very well. I'd been having some goddamn funny dreams, and it scared me because quite a few of them were wet dreams, and they weren't the kind that you're supposed to wake up after with a wet sheet. There was one where I was walking through the basement of an old castle that looked like something out of an old Universal Pictures movie. There was a coffin with the top up, and when I looked inside, I saw my father with his hands crossed on his chest. He was neatly decked out. Pun intended, I guess. In his dress navy uniform, and there was a stake driven into his crotch. He opened his eyes and smiled at me. His teeth were fangs. In another one, my mother was giving me an enema, and I was begging her to hurry because Joe was outside waiting for me. Only Joe was there, looking over her shoulder, and he had his hands on her breasts while she worked the little red rubber bulb that was pumping soap suds into my ass. There were others, featuring a cast of thousands, but I don't want to go into them. It was all Napoleon XIV stuff. I found the pipe wrench in the garage in an old toolbox. It wasn't a very big piece, but there was a rust-clotted socket on one end, and it hefted heavy in my hand. It was winter then, and I used to wear a big bulky sweater to school every day. I have an aunt that sends me two of those every year, birthday and Christmas. She knits them, and they always come down below my hips. So I started to carry the pipe wrench in my back pocket. It went every place with me. If everyone ever noticed, they never said. For a little while it evened things up, but not for long. There were days when I came home feeling like a guitar string that has been tuned 5 octaves past its proper position. On those days I'd say hi to Mom, then go upstairs and either weep or giggle into my pillow until it felt as if all my guts were going to blow up. That scared me. When you do things like that, you are ready for the loony bin. The day that I almost killed Mr. Carlson was the 3rd of March. It was raining, and the last of the snow was just trickling away in nasty little rivulets. I guess I don't have to go into what happened, because most of you were there and saw it. I had the pipe wrench in my back pocket. Carlson called me up to do a problem on the board, and I've always hated that. I'm lousy in chemistry. It made me break out in a sweat every time I had to go up to that board. It was something about weight stress on an inclined plane. I forget just what, but I fucked it all up. I remember thinking he had his fucking gall getting me up here in front of everybody to mess around with an inclined plane deal, which was really a physics problem. He probably had it left over from his last class. And he started to make fun of me. He was asking me if I remembered what 2 and 2 made, if I'd ever heard of long division. Wonderful invention, he said, ha ha. A regular Henny Youngman. When I did it wrong for the 3rd time, he said, well, that's just wonderful, Charlie, wonderful. He sounded just like Dickie Cable. He sounded so much like him that I turned around fast to look. He sounded so much like him that I reached for my back pocket where that pipe wrench was tucked away before I even thought. My stomach was all drawn up tight, and I thought I was just going to lean down and blow my cookies all over the floor. I hit the back pocket with my hand, and the pipe wrench fell out. It hit the floor and clanged. Mr. Carlson looked at it. Now, just what is that? He asked, and started to reach for it. Don't touch it, I said, and reached down and grabbed it for myself. Let me see it, Charlie. He put his hand out for it. I felt as if I were going in 12 different directions at once. Part of my mind was screaming at me, really, actually screaming, like a child in a dark room where there are horrible, grinning boogeymen. Don't, I said, and everybody was looking at me, all of them staring. You can give it to me, or you can give it to Mr. Denver, he said. And then a funny thing happened to me, except when I think about it, it wasn't funny at all. There must be a line in all of us, a very clear one, just like the line that divides the light side of a planet from the dark. I think they call that line the Terminator. That's a very good word for it, because at one moment I was freaking out, and at the next I was as cool as a cucumber. I'll give it to you, Skinner, I said, and thumped the socket end into my palm. Where do you want it? He looked at me with his lips pursed. With those heavy tortoiseshell glasses he wore, he looked like some kind of bug, a very stupid kind. The thought made me smile. I thumped the business end of the wrench into my palm again. All right, Charlie, he said. Give that thing to me and then go up to the office. I'll come up after class. Eat shit, I said, and swung the pipe wrench behind me. It thocked against the slate skin of the blackboard and little chips flew out. There was yellow chalk dust on the socket end, but it didn't seem any worse for the encounter. Mr. Carlson, on the other hand, winced as though it had been his mother I'd hit instead of some fucking torture machine blackboard. It was quite an insight into his character, I can tell you. So I hit the blackboard again. And again. Charlie! It's a treat to beat your meat on the Mississippi mud, I sang, whacking the blackboard in time. Every time I hit it, Mr. Carlson jumped. Every time Mr. Carlson jumped, I felt a little better. Transitional action analysis, baby. Dig it. The mad bomber, that poor sad sack from Waterbury, Connecticut, must have been the most well-adjusted American of the last quarter century. Charlie, I'll see that you're suspended. I turned around and began to whack away at the chalk ledge. I had already made a hell of a hole in the board itself. It wasn't such a tough board at that, not once you had its number. Erasers and chalk fell on the floor, puffing up dust. I was just on the brink of realizing you could have anybody's number if you held a big enough stick, when Mr. Carlson grabbed me. I turned around and hit him, just once. There was a lot of blood. He fell on the floor, and his tortoiseshell glasses fell off and skated about 8 feet. I think that's what broke the spell, the sight of those glasses sliding across the chalk-dusty floor, leaving his face bare and defenseless, looking the way it must look when he was asleep. I dropped the pipe wrench on the floor and walked out without looking back. I went upstairs and told them what I had done. Jerry Kesserling picked me up in a patrol car, and they sent Mr. Carlson to Central Maine General Hospital, where an X-ray showed that he had a hairline fracture just above the frontal lobe. I understand they picked 4 splinters of bone out of his brain, a few dozen more, and they could have put them together with airplane glue, so they spelled asshole and given it to him for his birthday with my compliments. There were conferences. Conferences with my father, with good old Tom, with Don Grace, and with every possible combination and permutation of the above. I conferenced with everybody but Mr. Fazio, the janitor. Through it all, my father kept admirably calm. My mother would come out of the house and was on tranquilizers, but every now and then during these civilized conversations, he would turn an icy, speculative eye on me, that I knew eventually we would be having our own conference. He could have killed me cheerfully with his bare hands. In a simpler time, he might have done it. There was a very touching apology to a bandage-wrapped, black-eyed Mr. Carlson and his stony-eyed wife. Distraught, haven't been myself, sorrier than I can say. But I got no apology for being badgered in front of the chemistry class as I stood sweating at the blackboard with all the numbers looking like 5th-century Punic. No apology from Dickie Cable or Dana Collette, or from your friendly neighborhood creaking thing who told me through tight lips on the way home from the hospital that he wanted to see me out in the garage after I had changed my clothes. I thought about that as I took off my sport jacket and my best slacks and put on jeans and an old chambray work shirt. I thought about not going, just heading off down the road instead. I thought about just going out and taking it. Something in me rebelled at that. I had been suspended. I had spent 5 hours in a holding cell in Placerville Center before my father and my hysterical mother. Why did you do it, Charlie? Why? Forked over the bail money. The charges, at the joint agreement of the school, the cops, and Mr. Carlson, not his wife, she had been hoping I'd get at least 10 years, had been dropped later. One way or the other, I thought my father and I owed each other something. And so I went out to the garage. It's a musty, oil-smelling place, but completely trim. Shipshape, it's his place, and he keeps it that way. A place for everything and everything in its place. Yo-ho-ho, matey. The riding lawnmower placed neatly with its nose against the wall. The gardening and landscaping tools neatly hung up on nails. Jar tops nailed to the roof beams so jars of nails could be screwed into them at eye level. Stacks of old magazines neatly tied up with twine. Argosy, Blue Book, True, Saturday Evening Post. The ranch wagon neatly parked facing out. He was standing there in an old faded pair of twill khakis and a hunting shirt. For the first time, I noticed how old he was starting to look. His belly had always been as flat as a 2x4, but now it was bulging out a little. Too many beers down at Gogan's. There seemed to be more veins in his nose burst out into little purple deltas under the skin, and the lines around his mouth and eyes were deeper. "What's your mother doing?" he asked me. "Sleeping," I said. She had been sleeping a lot. With the help of a Librium prescription. Her breath was sour and dry with it. It smelled like dreams gone rancid. "Good," he said, nodding. "That's how we want it, isn't it?" He started taking off his belt. "I'm going to take the hide off you," he said. "No," I said, "you're not." He paused, the belt half out of the loops. "What?" "If you come at me with that thing, I'm going to take it away from you," I said. My voice was trembling and uneven. "I'm going to do it for the time you threw me on the ground when I was little and then lied about it to Mom. I'm going to do it for every time you belted me across the face for doing something wrong without giving me a second chance. I'm going to do it for that hunting trip when you said you'd slit her nose open if you ever caught her with another man." He had gone a deadly pale. Now it was his voice trembling. You gutless, spineless wonder. Do you think you can blame this on me? You go tell that to that pansy psychiatrist if you want to, that one with the pipe. Don't try it on me. You stink, I said. You fucked up your marriage and you fucked up your only child. You come on and try to take me if you think you can. I'm out of school. Your wife's turning into a pill head. You're nothing but a booze hound. I was crying. You come on and try it, you dumb fuck. You better stop it, Charlie, he said. Before I stop just wanting to punish you and start wanting to kill you. Go ahead and try, I said, crying harder. I've wanted to kill you for 13 years. One end of his navy-issue belt wrapped in his fist, the other end, the buckle end, dangling down. He swung it at me and I ducked. It went by my shoulder and hit the hood of his country squire wagon with a hard clank, scoring the finish. His tongue was caught between his teeth and his eyes were bulging. He looked the way he had that day I broke the storm windows. Suddenly I wondered if that was the way he looked when he made love to my mother, or what passed for it. If that's what she had to look up at while she was pinned under him, the thought froze me with such a bolt of disgusted revelation that I forgot to duck the next one. The buckle came down alongside my face, ripped into my cheek, pulling it open in a long furrow. It bled a lot. It felt like the side of my face and neck had been doused in warm water. Oh, God, he said. Oh, God, Charlie. My eye had watered shut on that side, but I could see him coming toward me with the other. I stepped to meet him and grabbed the end of the belt and pulled. He wasn't expecting it. It jerked him off balance, and when he started to run a little to catch it back, I tripped him up and he thumped to the oil-stained concrete floor. Maybe he had forgotten I wasn't 4 anymore, or 9 years old and cowering in a tent, having to take a whiz while he yucked it up with his friends. Maybe he had forgotten or never knew that little boys grow up remembering every blow and word of scorn, that they grow up and want to eat their fathers alive. A harsh little grunt escaped him as he hit the concrete. He opened his hands to break his fall, and I had the belt. I doubled it and brought it down on his broad khaki ass. It made a loud smack, and it probably didn't hurt much, but he cried out in surprise, and I smiled. It hurt my cheek to smile. He had really beaten the shit out of my cheek. He got up wearily. Charlie, put that down, he said. Let's take you to the doctor and get that stitched up. You better say yes, sir, to the Marines, you see, if your own kid can knock you down, I said. That made him mad, and he lunged at me, and I hit him across the face with the belt. He put his hands up to his face, and I dropped the belt and hit him in the stomach as hard as I could. The air whiffled out of him, and he doubled over. His belly was soft, even softer than it had looked. I didn't know whether to feel disgust or pity suddenly. It occurred to me that the man I really wanted to hurt was safely out of my reach, standing behind a shield of years. He straightened up, looking pale and sick. There was a red mark across his forehead where I had hit him with the belt. Okay, he said and turned around. He pulled a hard-head rake off the wall. If that's how you want it. I reached out beside me and pulled the hatchet off the wall and held it up with one hand. That's how I want it, I said. Take one step and I'll cut your head off if I can. So we stood there, trying to figure out if we meant it. Then he put the rake back and I put the hatchet back. There was no love in it, no love in the way we looked at each other. He didn't say, if you'd had the guts to do that 5 years ago, none of this would have happened, son. Come on, I'll take you down to Gogan's and buy you a beer in the back room. And I didn't say I was sorry. It happened because I got big enough, that was all. None of it changed anything. Now I wish it was him I'd killed if I had to kill anyone. This thing on the floor between my feet is a classic case of misplaced aggression. Come on, he said. Let's get that stitched up. I can drive myself. I'll drive you. And so he did. We went down to the emergency room in Brunswick, and the doctor put 6 stitches in my cheek, and I told him that I had tripped over a chunk of stove wood in the garage and cut my cheek on a fireplace screen my dad was blacking. We told Mom the same thing, and that was the end of it. We never discussed it again. He never tried to tell me what to do again. We lived in the same house, but we walked in wide circles around each other like a pair of old toms. If I had to guess, I'd say he'll get along without me very well, like the song says. During the second week of April, they sent me back to school with the warning that my case was still under consideration and I would have to go see Mr. Grace every day. They acted like they were doing me a favor. Some favor. It was like being popped back into the cabinet of Dr. Caligari. It didn't take as long to go bad this time. The way people looked at me in the halls, the way I knew they were talking about me in the teacher's rooms, the way nobody would even talk to me anymore except Joe, and I wasn't very cooperative with Grace. Yes, folks, things got bad very fast indeed, and they went from bad to worse. But I've always been fairly quick on the uptake, and I don't forget many lessons that I've learned well. I certainly learned the lesson about how you could get anyone's number with a big enough stick. My father picked up the hardhead rake, presumably planning to trepan my skull with it, but when I picked up the hatchet, he put it back. I never saw that pipe wrench again, but what the fuck? I didn't need that anymore because that stick wasn't big enough. I had known about the pistol in my father's desk for 10 years. Near the end of April, I started to carry it to school. Chapter 30. I looked up at the wall clock. It was 12:30. I drew in all my mental breath and got ready to sprint down the home stretch. "So ends the short, brutal saga of Charles Everett Decker," I said. "Question?" Susan Brooks said very quietly in the dim room, "I'm sorry for you, Charlie." It was like the crack of damnation. Don Lordy was looking at me in a hungry way that reminded me of Jaws for the second time that day. Sylvia was smoking the last cigarette in her pack. Pat Fitzgerald labored on his plane, crimping the paper wings, the usual funny, sly expression gone from his face, replaced by something that was wooden and carved. Sandra Cross still seemed to be in a pleasant daze. Even Ted Jones seemed to have his mind on other matters, perhaps on a door he had forgotten to latch when he was 10. Or a dog he might once have kicked. "If that's all, then it brings us to the final order of business in our brief but enlightening stay together," I said. "Have you learned anything today? Who knows the final order of business? Let's see." I watched them. There was nothing. I was afraid it wouldn't come, couldn't come. So tight, so frozen, all of them. When you're 5 and you hurt, you make a big noise under the world. At 10, you whimper. But by the time you make 15, you begin to eat the poisoned apples that grow on your own inner tree of pain. It's the Western way of enlightenment. You begin to cram your fists into your mouth to stifle the screams. You bleed on the inside. But they had gone so far. And then Thigpen looked up from his pencil. He was smiling a small red-eyed smile, the smile of a ferret. His hand crept up into the air, the fingers still clenched around his cheap writing instrument. "Bebop-a-lula, she's my baby." So then it was easier for the rest of them. One electrode begins to arc and sputter, and yoicks, look, Professor, the monster walks tonight. Susan Brooks put her hand up next. Then there were several together. Sandra raised hers, Grace Stanner raised hers, delicately, and Irma Bates did likewise. Corky, Don, Pat, Sarah Pastern, some smiling a little, most of them solemn. Tannis, Nancy Kaskin, Dick Keene and Mike Gavin, both renowned in the Placerville Greyhounds backfield. George and Harmon, who played chess together in study hall. Melvin Thomas, Ann Lasky. At the end, all of them were up, all but one. I called on Carol Granger because I thought she deserved her moment. You would have thought that she might have had the most trouble making the switch, crossing the Terminator, so to speak. But she had done it almost effortlessly, like a girl shedding her clothes in the bushes after dusk had come to the class picnic. "Carol," I said, "what's the answer?" She thought about how to word it. She put a finger up to the small dimple beside her mouth as she thought, and there was a furrow in her milk-white brow. "We have to help," she said. "We have to help show Ted where he has gone wrong." That was a very tasteful way to put it, I thought. "Thank you, Carol," I said. She blushed. I looked at Ted, who had come back to the here and now. He was glaring again, but in kind of a confused way. "I think the best thing," I said, "would be if I became a sort of combination judge and public attorney. Everyone else can be witnesses, and, of course, you're the defendant, Ted." Ted laughed wildly. "You?" he said. "Oh, Jesus, Charlie, who do you think you are? You're crazy as a bat." "Do you have a statement?" I asked him. "You're not going to play tricks with me, Charlie. I'm not saying a darn thing. I'll save my speech for when we get out of here." His eyes swept his classmates accusingly and distrustfully. "And I'll have a lot to say." "You know what happens to squealers, Rocco," I said in a tough Jimmy Cagney voice. I brought the pistol up suddenly, pointed it at his head, and screamed, "Bang!" Ted shrieked in surprise. Ann Lasky laughed merrily. "Shut up!" Ted yelled at her. "Don't you tell me to shut up," she said. "What are you so afraid of?" "What?" His jaw dropped. The eyes bulged. In that moment, I felt a great deal of pity for him. The Bible says the snake tempted Eve with the apple. What would have happened if he had been forced to eat it himself? Ted half rose from his seat, trembling. What am I? He pointed a shivering finger at Anne, who did not cringe at all.
You goddamn silly bitch! He has got a gun! He is crazy! He has shot two people! Dead! He is holding us here!
Not me, he isn't, Irma said. I could have walked right out. We've learned some very good things about ourselves, Ted, Susan said coldly. I don't think you're being very helpful, closing yourself in and trying to be superior. Don't you realize that this could be the most meaningful experience of our lives? He's a killer, Ted said tightly. He killed two people. This isn't TV. Those people aren't going to get up and go off to their dressing rooms to wait for the next take. They're really dead. He killed them. Soul killer, Pigpen hissed suddenly. Where the fuck do you think you get off? Dick Keene asked. All this just shakes the shit out of your tight little life, doesn't it? You didn't think anybody'd find out about you banging Sandy, did you? Or your mother. Ever think about her? You think you're some kind of white knight? I'll tell you what you are. You're a cocksucker. Witness! Witness! Grace cried merrily, waving her hand. Ted Jones buys girly magazines. I've seen him in Ronnie's Variety doing it. Beat off much, Ted? Harmon asked. He was smiling viciously. And you were a star scout, Pat said dolorously. Ted twitched from them like a bear that has been tied to a post for the villagers' amusement. I don't masturbate, he yelled. Right, Corky said disgustedly. I bet you really stink in bed, Sylvia said. She looked at Sandra. Did he stink in bed? We didn't do it in bed, Sandra said. We were in a car, and it was over so quick. Yeah, that's what I figured. All right, Ted said. His face was sweaty. He stood up. I'm walking out of here. You're all crazy. I'll tell them. He stopped and added with a strange and touching irrelevancy. I never meant what I said about my mother. He swallowed. You can shoot me, Charlie, but you can't stop me. I'm going out. I put the gun down on the blotter. I have no intention of shooting you, Ted. But let me remind you that you haven't really done your duty. That's right, Dick said. And after Ted had taken two steps toward the door, Dick came out of his seat, took two running steps of his own, and collared him. Ted's face dissolved into utter amazement. Hey, Dick, he said. Don't you dick me, you son of a bitch. Ted tried to give him an elbow in the belly, and then his arms were pinned behind him, one by Pat and one by Georgiana. Sandra Cross got slowly out of her seat and walked to him demurely like a girl on a country road. Ted's eyes were bulging, half mad. I could taste what was coming, the way you can taste thunderheads before summer rain, and the hail that comes with it sometimes. She stopped before him, and an expression of sly, mocking devotion crossed her face and was gone. She put a hand out, touched the collar of his shirt. The muscles of his neck bunched as he jerked away from her. Dick and Pat and George held him like springs. She reached slowly inside the open collar of the khaki shirt and began to pull it open, popping the buttons. There was no sound in the room but the tiny flat tick-tick as the buttons fell to the floor and rolled. He was wearing no undershirt. His flesh was bare and smooth. She moved as if to kiss it, and he spit in her face. Pigpen smiled from over Sandra's shoulder, the grubby court jester with the king's paramour. I could put your eyes out, he said. You know that? Pop them out, just like olives. Point, point. Let me go, Charlie. Make them let me. He cheats, Sarah Pastern said loudly. He always looks at my answer sheet in French, always. Sandra stood before him, now looking down, a sweet murmurous smile barely curving the bow of her lips. The first two fingers of her right hand touched the slick spittle on her cheek lightly. Here, Billy Sawyer whispered. Here's something for you, handsome. He crept up behind Ted on tippy-toe and suddenly pulled his hair. Ted screamed. He cheats on the laps in gym, too, Don said harshly. You really quit football because you didn't have no sauce, didn't you? Please, Ted said. Please, Charlie. He had begun to grin oddly, and his eyeballs were shiny with tears. Sylvia had joined the little circle around him. She might have been the one who goosed him, but I couldn't really see. They were moving around him in a slow kind of dance that was nearly beautiful. Fingers pinched and pulled, questions were asked, accusations made, Irma Bates pushed a ruler down the back of his pants. Somehow his shirt was ripped off and flew to the back of the room in two tatters. Ted was breathing in great high whoops. Ann Lasky began to rub the bridge of his nose with an eraser. Corky scurried back to his desk like a good mouse, found a bottle of Carter's ink, and dumped it in his hair. Hands flew out like birds and rubbed it in briskly. Ted began to weep and talk in strange, unconnected phrases. "Soul, brother?" Pat Fitzgerald asked. He was smiling, whacking Ted's bare shoulders lightly with a notebook in cadence. "Be my soul, brother? That right? Little head start? Little free lunch? That right? Brothers? Be soul brothers?" "Got your silver star, hero," Dick said, and raised his knee, placing it expertly in the big muscle of Ted's thigh. Ted screamed. His eyes bulged and rolled toward me, the eyes of a horse staved on a high fence. "Please, please, Charlie, please." And then Nancy Kaskin stuffed a large wad of notebook paper into his mouth. He tried to spit it out, but Sandra rammed it back in. "That will teach you to spit," she said reproachfully. Harmon knelt and pulled off one of his shoes. He rubbed it in Ted's inky hair and then slammed the sole against Ted's chest. It left a huge, grotesque footprint. "Admit one," he crowed. Tentatively, almost demurely, Carol stepped on Ted's stockinged foot and twisted her heel. Something in his foot snapped. Ted blubbered. He sounded like he was begging somewhere behind the paper, but you couldn't really tell. Pigpen darted in spider-like and suddenly bit his nose. There was a sudden black pause. I noticed that I had turned the pistol around so that the muzzle was pointed at my head. But of course that would not be at all cricket. I unloaded it and put it carefully in the top drawer on top of Mrs. Underwood's plan book. I was quite confident that this had not been in today's lesson plan at all. They were smiling at Ted, who hardly looked human at all anymore. In that brief flick of time, they looked like gods, young, wise, and golden. Ted did not look like a god. Ink ran down his cheeks in blue-black teardrops. The bridge of his nose was bleeding, and one eye glared disjointedly toward no place. Paper protruded through his teeth. He breathed in great white snuffles of air. I had time to think. "We have got it on. Now we have got it all the way on." They fell on him. Chapter 31. I had Corky pull up the shades before they left. He did it with quick, jerky motions. There were now what seemed like hundreds of cruisers out there, thousands of people. It was 3 minutes of one. The sunlight hurt my eyes. "Goodbye," I said. "Goodbye," Sandra said. They all said goodbye, I think, before they went out. Their footfalls made a funny, echoey noise going down the hall. I closed my eyes and imagined a giant centipede wearing Georgia Giants on each of its 100 feet. When I opened them again, they were walking across the bright green of the lawn. I wished they had used the sidewalk. Even after all that had happened, it was still a hell of a lawn. The last thing I remember seeing of them was that their hands were streaked with black ink. People enveloped them. One of the reporters, throwing caution to the winds, eluded three policemen and raced down to where they were pell-mell. The last one to be swallowed up was Carol Granger. I thought she looked back, but I couldn't tell for sure. Philbrick started to walk stolidly toward the school. Flashbulbs were popping all over the place. Time was short. I went over to where Ted was leaning against the green cinder block wall. He was sitting with his legs splayed out below the bulletin board, which was full of notices from the Mathematical Society of America, which nobody ever read, Peanuts comic strips, the acne of humor in the late Mrs. Underwood's estimation, and a poster showing Bertrand Russell and a quote, "Gravity alone proved the existence of God." But any undergraduate in creation could have told Bertrand that it has been conclusively proved that there is no gravity. The earth just sucks. I squatted beside Ted. I pulled the crumpled wad of math paper out of his mouth and laid it aside. Ted began to drool. "Ted." He looked past me over my shoulder. "Ted," I said, and patted his cheek gently. He shrank away. His eyes rolled wildly. "You're going to get better," I said. "You're going to forget this day ever happened." Ted made mewling sounds. "Or maybe you won't. Maybe you'll go on from here, Ted. Build from this. Is that such an impossible idea?" It was for both of us, and being so close to Ted had begun to make me very nervous. The intercom chinked open. It was Philbrick. He was puffing and blowing again. "Decker, right here. Come out with your hands up." I sighed. You come down and get me, Philbrick, old sport. I'm pretty goddamn tired. This psycho business is a hell of a drain on the glands. All right, he said, tough. They'll be shooting in the gas canisters in just about 1 minute. Better not, I said. I looked at Ted. Ted didn't look back. He just kept on looking into emptiness. Whatever he saw there must have been mighty tasty because he was still drooling down his chin. You forgot to count noses. There's still one of them down here. He's hurt. That was something of an understatement. His voice was instantly wary. Who? Ted Jones. How is he hurt? Stubbed his toe. He's not there. You're lying. I wouldn't lie to you, Philbrick, and jeopardize our beautiful relationship. No answer. Puff, snort, blow. Come on down, I invited. The gun is unloaded. It's in a desk drawer. We can play a couple of cribbage hands, then you can take me out and tell all the papers how you did it single-handed. You might even make the cover of Time if we work it right. Chink, he was off the horn. I closed my eyes and put my face in my hands. All I saw was gray. Nothing but gray. Not even a flash of white light. For no reason at all, I thought of New Year's Eve, when all those people crowd into Times Square and scream like jackals as the lighted ball slides down the pole, ready to shed its thin party glare on 365 new days in this best of all possible worlds. I have always wondered what it would be like to be caught in one of those crowds, screaming and not able to hear your own voice, your individuality momentarily wiped out and replaced with the blind, empathic overslop of the crowd's lurching, angry anticipation, hip to hip and shoulder to shoulder with no one in particular. I began to cry. When Philbrick stepped through the door, he glanced down at the drooling Ted thing and then up at me. What in the name of God did you... he began. I made as if to grab something behind Mrs. Underwood's desktop row of books and plants. Here it comes, you shit cop, I screamed. He shot me 3 times. Chapter 32. Those who would be informed in this matter, draw ye near and know ye then by these presents. Charles Everett Decker, convicted in Superior Court this day, August 27, 1976, of the willful murder of Jean Alice Underwood, and also convicted this day, August 27, 1976, of the willful murder of John Downs Vance, both human beings. It has been determined by 5 state psychiatrists that Charles Everett Decker cannot at this time be held accountable for his actions by reason of insanity. It is therefore the decision of this court that he be remanded to the Augusta State Hospital, where he will be held in treatment until such time as he can be certified responsible to answer for his acts. To this writ I have set my hand. Signed, Judge Samuel K. N. Delevingne. In other words, until shit sticks on the moon, baby. Chapter 33. Interoffice Memo. From Dr. Anderson to Rich Gossage, Administrative Wing. Subject, Theodore Jones. Rich, I'm still loath to try the shock treatments on this boy, although I can't explain it even to myself. Call it hunch. Of course, I can't justify hunch to the board of directors or to Jones's uncle, who is footing the bill, which in a private institution like Woodlands don't come cheap, as we both know. If there is no movement in the next 4 to 6 weeks, we'll go on with the standard electroshock therapy, but for now I would like to run the standard drug schedule again, plus a few not so standard. I am thinking of both synthetic mescaline and psilocybin, if you concur. Will Greenberger has had a great deal of success with semi-catatonic patients, as you know, and these 2 hallucinogens have played a major part in his therapy. Jones is such a strange case. God damn it, if we only could be sure what had gone on in that classroom after that Decker individual had the shades pulled down. Diagnosis hasn't changed. Flat-line catatonic state with some signs of deterioration. I might as well admit to you up front, Rich, that I am not as hopeful for this boy as I once was. November 3rd, 1976. Chapter 34. December 5th, 1976. Dear Charlie, they tell me you can have mail now, so I thought I would drop you a line. Maybe you noticed this is postmarked Boston. Your old buddy finally made the big time, and I'm taking 16 hours here at BU. That stands for Bullshit Unlimited. It's all pretty slushy except for my English class. The instructor assigned us the book called The Postman Always Rings Twice that was really good, and I got an A on the exam. It's by James Cain. Did you ever read it? I'm thinking about majoring in English. How's that for a laugh? Must be your influence, and you were always the brains of the combination. I saw your mom just before I left Placerville, and she said you were just about all healed up and the last of the drains were out 3 weeks ago. I was sure glad to hear it. She said you aren't talking much. That doesn't sound like you, Skinner. It would sure be a loss to the world if you clammed up and just scrunched in a corner all day. Although I haven't been home since the semester started, Sandy Cross wrote me a letter with a lot of news about all the people at home. Will the bastards censor this part? I bet they read all your mail. Sandy herself decided not to go to college this year. She's just sort of hanging around, waiting for something to happen, I guess. I might as well tell you that I dated her a couple of times last summer, but she just seemed kind of distant. She asked me to say hi to you, so hi from Sandy. Maybe you know what happened to Pigpen. No one in town can believe it about him and Dick Keene. Following has been censored as possibly upsetting to patient. So you can never tell what people are going to do, can you? Carol Granger's valedictory, spelling, speech, was reprinted by 17 Magazine. As I remember, it was on self-integrity and a normal response to it, or some such happy horseshit. We would have had some fun ranking that one out, right, Charlie? Oh, yeah, and Irma Bates is going out with some hippie from Lewiston. I guess they were even in a demonstration when Robert Dole came to Portland to campaign in the presidential election, Scott. They were arrested and then let go when Dole flew out. Mrs. Bates must be having birds about it. Can't you just see Irma trying to brain Robert Dole with a Gus Hall campaign sign? Ha ha, that just kills me. We would have had some laughs over that one too, Charlie. God, I miss your old cracked ass sometimes. Tracy Stanner, that cute little chick, is going to get married. And that's also a local sensation. It boggles the mind. Following has been censored as possibly upsetting to patient. Anyway, you can never tell what sort of monkey shines people are going to get up to, right? Well, I guess that's all for now. I hope they are treating you right, Ferd, as you've got to be out of there as soon as they'll let you. And if they start letting you have visitors, I want you to know that I will be the first in line. There are a lot of us pulling for you, Charlie, pulling hard. People haven't forgotten. You know what I mean. You have to believe that. With love, your friend Joe McKay. Chapter 35. I haven't had any bad dreams for 2 weeks almost. I do lots of jigsaw puzzles. They give me custard and I hate it, but I eat it just the same. They think I like it. So I have a secret again. Finally, I have a secret again. My mom sent me the yearbook. I haven't unwrapped it yet, but maybe I will. Maybe next week I will. I think I could look at all the senior pictures and not tremble a bit. Pretty soon, just as soon as I can make myself believe that there won't be any black streaks on their hands, that their hands will be clean, with no ink. Maybe next week I'll be completely sure of that. About the custard, it's only a little secret. But having a secret makes me feel better, like a human being again. That's the end. I have to turn off the light now. Good night.